Our next case is 2021-611, the State of Ohio ex rel Christopher Hicks versus Claremont County Board of Commissioners. Do we have Mr. Miller Novak?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Landis? And is Mr. Galvin here?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Landis.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Mark Landis. I'm here for Claremont County. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal to give to my brother, who represents all of the other local governments gravely concerned about the outcome of this case. And he'll do the rebuttal then. Your Honor, my client was sued for 18 meetings in executive session, each of which started with a proper motion, a second, a roll call, and an appropriate recitation of a legitimate and recognized statutory exception to go into executive session. Mr. Hicks sued over 18 of these meetings, was allowed to depose each of the four people in the executive session, and found no evidence of any wrongdoing, no evidence that the topic of the discussion went beyond the stated reason for the executive session. And yet, a divided court of appeals found that my client had to be found in wrongdoing and must pay $80,000 in taxpayer funds to Mr. Hicks. We ask this court to recognize that the burden under the statutory language and also the common law, the burden when you bring a case stays with the person bringing the case throughout the case and was not met here, and also that the presumption of regularity that attaches to every government function so that they can act in good government without an overlay of fear of litigation can allow you to find in this case, allow any court to find in this case, that when there is no evidence, the presumption of regularity allows us to understand that there was in fact no violation. And certainly here, where the statute specifically says that no attorney's fees shall be awarded unless there was unreasonable action by those making the decision, certainly a case in which you decided to take discretionary jurisdiction to sort this out, and there was, in fact, a divided panel at the Court of Appeals, would indicate that it was objectively reasonable for my client to act the way they did. So we ask you to find that the burden stays with the person bringing the case, that there is a presumption of regularity that applies here. There's no carve-out from that presumption.
Counsel,
and that attorney's fees should be as accorded.
All right, counsel, is it my understanding, is it correct that when your clients went into executive session, they used a catch-all phrase as to why they're going into executive session? They didn't say, we're going into executive session to talk about, Bob Smith's employment with the township. It was whatever the terms were that they used, it was an all-encompassing, and it was the same every time they went into executive session. Is that right?
Almost. Out of 18 times, 9 times they read the entirety of the exception, which is very typical for all other exceptions. And in 9 times they parsed out and left out some of the phrases that were in that exception.
But they weren't talking about those things when they were in executive session, the ones that they left out.
There's actually no evidence about that. The people that gave sworn testimony indicated they had no specific recollection. They talked about what was typical and ordinary for them to do. In a county as large as Claremont, they said that they talked about multiple people and multiple things each time they went into session, and that was unrebutted. The staff actually knew what they were going to talk about. The commissioners who were moving did not. So it was typical for them to be told that they are going to go in executive session to talk about those kinds of things, and they were as inclusive as they thought they should be. When you go to demote someone, you might talk about promoting somebody else into that. When you talk about firing somebody, you may need to figure out who you're going to hire for that job. And so they were as expansive as they could be to assure that they gave notice to everybody in good government as to what they might talk about in session. There was no evidence that they talked about anything other than that. They didn't talk about buying property or anything else other than the statement that they made, they fulfilled, and that's the sole evidence in the case.
Well, counsel, how would anyone know whether anything was talked about in executive session that was inappropriate if they're not there to say it? And recognizing the confidentiality of information in executive session, if there's no, I mean, what if things were discussed there and decided on or voted on that were not appropriate for executive session?
Great question. So that there's two, I can think of two possibilities. One, the Court of Appeals, the divided Court of Appeals said, you must take notes. Didn't say how many notes. And it's clear that whatever notes would be taken would in fact be public record. And so it leaves the board with a Hobson's choice. Do you want the benefit of the discussion that the General Assembly says that you can have about whether somebody did wrong on the job, let's say, as you do with lawyers routinely, or do you have in this case, they all had to stick their paw in the air and swear to an oath. And they all testified that all they talked about were those matters that were covered in that exception. And so the answer, I think, the more practical answer is, if you think you have cause to bring a case, which I'm not sure they did here, then you can have discovery that gives you that answer. In order to find against my client, you'd have to find that four people were making things up about 18 meetings. That's not the way good government goes.
But wasn't some of the testimony a lack of recollection?
It absolutely was. It was about a year after, I think, the last meeting. And they talked about, generally, we talk about multiple people, we talk about multiple functions, and we don't know what we're talking about until we get in there. And so there is an absence of evidence, which indicates that the presumption, the burden, was inverted in this case.
Mr.
There's
Landis,
no way for them to win otherwise.
Mr. Landis, so if a plaintiff wants to bring an action and the reason for going into executive session is sort of a catch-all like this, and there's no minutes taken, you know, in discovery, how does a plaintiff even know which staff person who would supply the information to the board they should be trying to depose if it's not limited to the exact issue why they're going into executive session? I'm talking about the burden shifting. How would a plaintiff know?
Well, here they brought a case, and here they asked everybody in this session, all 18 of them, what happened. And so they had full discovery and found absolutely no wrongdoing, and yet won and got $80,000. And I should say, too, that we say catch-all. We used to say catch-all when you'd say, I'm going into executive session for personnel. And you didn't actually state what the statute said. That was found wrong by this court in a case called Long versus Cardington. This court's never said that you can't say the entirety of the exception to the open meeting statute. So that's what they did. You'd read all of the statute for why you're going into session for purchasing land, or read the exception for imminent or pending litigation. So that's what they did with this exception.
Counsel, so even if they aren't really going to discuss that, you think it's good for transparency to just put a laundry list of everything that's accepted under the statute?
I think it's better to be careful. I think it's better to be as accurate as you can be. I think these folks were trying to be as accurate as they could be. Sometimes they said them all. Sometimes they said some of them. You actually get sued the other way. So one of the many Mr. Ames cases in Portage County, he sued because they only picked out employment. And he said, well, you know, once I did discovery and I found out what they talked about, I'm not sure that how the person did during COVID and how we should have a succession plan for that person, whether that fit under the word employment. And so actually you can get shot at from both directions. Good thing.
So your best advice would be to a client, use the boilerplate if you're gonna, which is the words of the exception, when you call an executive session.
Certainly, if you're talking about one person for one thing, you could limit it to that and should limit it to that. here with Claremont County, and the statute says, by its terms, that you should list one or more of the topics you're going to address. So the statute supports what they did. Mm-hmm. The common law supports what they did. The Huth case and the Brenneman case both track exactly what happened here. There was a proper exception stated. They went into executive session. There was no evidence of wrongdoing. The presumption of regularity was allowed to carry the day. And so when both the statute says, in fact, that the person bringing the case must prove a violation, this is different than the public record statute, which merely says that the court must determine whether there was a violation. Here it says the person bringing the case must prove a violation. So both the statute and the common law support the concept that when Mr. Hicks decides to sue, he must carry that burden throughout. If you think that it's still helpful to the courts to have a burden of persuasion versus a burden of production shift, which the court very well put out for public records cases in Welsh Huggins, if you think that's helpful here, and it may or may not be, it's certainly true that the burden of production could be satisfied by the open meeting, by the motion, the second, the roll call vote. You know why they're going in. You've got that presumption of regularity that carries forward from there. Even if you shift a burden of production to the court or to the board should have been found to have satisfied that in this case.
Counsel, how would that presumption of regularity further the goal of the transparency under the OMA?
Fair enough. So we are balancing two things. And we want to know why someone is going into executive session. And so the General Assembly has decided that they should say why they're going into executive session. It actually requires a roll call vote. Voice vote's not good enough. So you have that by way of transparency. You are now on notice as to what's being discussed. So certainly in this case, where full discoveries occurred, transparency is satisfied by asking all the people that went behind the closed doors what happened. Beyond that, you have a problem, right? Because if you require notes of some substance, then anybody going into executive session is now making a public record as to what you talked about. So in order to balance the need of transparency against the allowance to go into executive session in the first place, the General Assembly has set it out in the statute in this way.
But can't you say what you talked about without being specific, of without naming employees, without naming, you know, at so-and-so start at 12:05, personnel matters were discussed with regard to five employees. The discussion ended at 1:55. I mean, why isn't that?
The statute says that minutes shall be kept, but not with the substance, but the general topic of the conversation. And so I would say that having said the reason for why you're going into executive session, you've captured the general topic of the conversation. If I were to go into a session on purchasing property, once you go beyond purchasing property, if you're going to purchase property for purposes of a school or for a particular property, certainly it cuts against the very reason why you're talking about it in private. So there'd be a place where, especially in a small town, you know, if you're going to talk about the dog warden, everybody knows who the dog warden is. You know, so it would be very difficult to parse out how much is enough and how much is not enough. And we'll have a lawyer full employment act before you know it.
But in this case, there were no minutes taken whatsoever.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and that's the crux of the problem.
Perhaps. There's not a requirement of minutes. It's only that the general nature of the subject be announced to the public, which was done here. You know, we've had people refuse to go into executive session since this case. We've had people suggest that you have to bring a lawyer in with you to take the notes that would be attorney-client privileged, unless you choose to waive if you get sued by Mr. Hicks or Mr. Ames or someone else. So this has radically changed the practice of good government in Ohio, and it needs your help.
You mentioned, I'm sorry.
Counsel, I want to go back to your statement about burden of persuasion and going forward. If you read a statement with a long list and you don't discuss everything in that list, are you being honest with the people?
Yes, Your Honor.
How is that?
Well, I think it's a matter of degree. If you read this text of all 8 exceptions and say we're going to exec session to talk about this, and you're really only talking about the dog warden, you know, that's an aw, come on, right? That's kind of like the Cincinnati case where they talked to 2 council people at a time. I think we'll know when we see it, when it's abusive. This is not abusive. It's not under-inclusive. We didn't just say personnel. All of the evidence, the undisputed evidence is, we talked about multiple people and multiple things. Certainly there was no, we're not gilding the lily or we're not being piggy here in the manner in which we're handling.
But I was getting to you then kind of morphed into the regularity issue. Is if you're talking about certain things in a list, and you list them, fine. But if you list everything and you only talked about 3 of them out of 8 or whatever, I'm just making up a number. How's that regular? Why should we bless that with regularity?
Sure. So the intent is to let the public know what's being discussed, generally speaking. And if you tell them that you're going to deal with this, I'm going to call it personnel exception, just by way of inclusiveness, if you're going to talk about the personnel exception, the public is on notice enough that that's what you're talking about. Now, whether you're talking about demotion or promotion, the public's not really supposed to know anyway, because that's why the General Assembly let them go into executive session to talk about people in the first place. You know, when you take up a case on discipline, you don't know whether it's going to be a suspension or disbarment or a public reprimand. You don't know at the end what it's going to be. You know you're talking about discipline. And if you had to announce what you're going into executive session to talk about a lawyer about, you may get it wrong too. And so the world is on good proper notice that this, we're not talking about real estate, we're not talking about imminent litigation, we're talking about something that we're allowed to talk about.
Yeah, but I guess I don't buy the analogy with the discipline, because you get a letter from disciplinary counsel saying what somebody said about you, or you get a letter after probable cause is found. And so it's kind of specific, and it only goes to you. Here, we're talking about the public. That's a different group of people than an individual being investigated. So again, if I make a list of 8 things and I only talk about 3, does the board believe they're misleading the public?
Well, I think that when you go into session, you may not know, just practically speaking, whether or not you're only going to be talking about demotion, or whether you may get to who can we promote into that job if we demote that guy out of it.
But that's adding something. I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'm saying you give a list of 8 things you're going to talk about, and the staff knows you're only going to really talk about 3. Isn't that not regular?
I would say it is regular in that we can't always predict what exactly will be said. We know we're going to talk about employees. There are multiple employees. How would we sort out at the beginning whether or not we get to all those things? So we want to give fair notice. It seems to me to be fair notice about what we're talking about. We're not talking about whether or not to have taxes raised. We're not talking about what the budget's going to be. So they know enough about what's happening to be on notice as to why we're in session.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Matt Miller Novak. I'm here on behalf of appellee Christopher Hicks. Government transparency is more important than government convenience, and I think that's what this case is about. There are 2 primary issues in the appellant's argument that are problematic. First, That's not an accurate depiction of the record. There was evidence that was presented by the relator that the appellee did violate the Open Meetings Act by not appropriately discussing things in executive session.
What was that evidence?
Your Honor, I think he represented that at every single executive session, they talked about multiple people and multiple things. That's not true. There were at least two executive sessions where only one person was discussed. I can remember one deposition with one of the commissioners saying they talked about one individual. Her initials were DR and only that employee. And that commissioner actually conceded in deposition that it was not logical that they could talk about both promoting and demoting that single person.
But so you're taking issue with the discrepancy of whether they discussed two or three employees or one, but regardless of the amount or the accuracy of the topics, whether there was one or three of them, aren't they still privileged communications in executive session?
Well, no, Your Honor. No, because I think there's two issues and there's two responsibilities for a government. Number one, that they properly motion enter executive session, and when they're in executive session, that what they're discussing with complies with that motion and remains within the scope. So they have to provide notice of why they're going into executive session. And to kind of discuss Lawn versus Cardington, I think the appellee's argument that reading the entire laundry list is sufficient notice is wrong, because it's absolutely no different than saying personnel issues. Because to read everything in that part of the statute is to read nothing at all. Because if you read the entire laundry list, it's the same thing as saying personnel issues. And if you look at Lawn versus Cardington, I believe it's in the footnote number one, the court actually states that the government has the duty to cite one or more. The implication of saying that you must cite one or more of the specified reasons certainly is that if you're only going to discuss one of those, let's say the termination of an employee, that you should only tell the public that you're going into executive session to discuss the firing or termination or employment of one employee rather than the promotion, demotion, and all those things.
But I don't understand how that would work in the real world. Maybe the idea is that we're going to talk about the termination of this employee, but what if another commissioner comes and says, you know what, I don't think she should be fired, but I think we should cut her pay, or I think we should suspend her for 2 weeks. I mean, those are the kind of things that happen when you discuss personnel matters. This isn't a situation where they read the laundry list and said land deals, personnel matters, you know, all those other things. But, mm-hmm. I mean, it seems fairly reasonable that when you have three county commissioners, that a discussion people may have different ideas, and it doesn't seem like it would almost be impossible to guess beforehand what someone might raise in regard to that specific employee or more, another employee.
Well, if you look at the matters listed in the statute, certainly you could probably divide them in both positive and negative. So there's a big difference between promotion and demotion. And certainly a public body could say that we're going into executive session to discuss the employment, firing, or demotion of an employee.
And what if another commissioner says, no, I think she's doing a great job. I'd promote her. They then violated the law?
No, they did not. Because if you cite the word employment, that doesn't necessarily limit the commissioners to talk about just promotion or demotion or something like that, because the word employment is one of the matters listed. So whether or not a person is going to be continued to be employed, how their compensation would be affected, all those
so
things.
So they could have just said employment, not said anything else then, and then they could talk about all those things in the statute.
Theoretically speaking, I think that
seems a pretty silly argument to make, that if they just said we're going to discuss the employment of an employer, it'd be okay, but if they added the other things, then it's not?
But if the evidence reflects that that's not the case, then I think that is, because in this case, for instance, an example, there was one individual and they were not talking. There was no evidence that they could present that they were talking about both promoting or demoting this person. And that's where the policy behind national broadcasting and the Open Records Act that places the burden on the government to provide evidence when it's trying to avail itself of an exception is important. Because I think the thing we always have to remember is that the public has no idea what's going on there, and the relator is always going to be at a significant disadvantage of information in that regard, number one. Number two, the spirit of the statute is to favor transparency and openness and to strictly construe exceptions and to place the burden on the government to use that responsibly.
So is your client's contention that these executive sessions are being conducted inappropriately or to discuss subjects that are not protected by the statute, mm-hmm. or that there is more than these particular sessions going on? I mean, I'm trying to really get the motivation behind the,
right.
the lawsuit.
Well, the lawsuit started, and some of the background facts is that during this period of time, the commissioners were also discussing a bed tax that they might pass. And so the clients, the beginning was, there was other causes of action that related that we did not succeed on, but they involved certain discussions that were not open in my client's theory regarding this bed tax. One of the executive session, again, there was evidence that was problematic that they went beyond the scope of why they entered the executive session.
And what was that evidence?
One of the commissioners, Commissioner Humphrey, kept a notebook. And in that notebook, he had notes of what happened in regular session as well as notes that happened in executive session. On one of the dates in March, he had in his executive session notes a list of hotels that were in the area and information that infers that they were indeed in executive session, potentially talking about this bed tax and this list of hotels. Obviously, the county does not employ anybody at the Holiday Inn that's down the road. Therefore, that is not something that would be within the purview of their own employees and discussions about that.
And what was the testimony of this?
Of that commissioner?
Yes.
Yes. When asked upon that, because, you know, we pointed to the fact in the notebook that you have written notes during this executive session that you were discussing these hotels, he just said, I couldn't recall. I may have talked about them in that executive session, I may have not. Of course, the other commissioner said, I can't recall. And that's the real danger here about no burden of production, no responsibility on the government.
When you say burden of production, you would want them to take minutes and then those minutes to be public record?
Well, no, I don't think that's necessarily.
What do you want?
We would want them to take some notes. I would not use the word minutes because I think the word minutes requires more than taking some record. But in this case, Your Honor, and I think the thing that wasn't always genuine in this case is that the procedure that was described in depositions is that every time an employment action was taken, there was an email sent from a department head to the administrators, telling them that they needed to talk to the commissioners in executive session, and then the administrator scheduled that executive session. And it was pretty obvious that the county was using the strategy of, we don't have that information, and neither do you. And they were kind of using evidence and our burden of proof as a sword and a shield. And that was the problem here. I think in most circumstances, Your Honor, some notes about the topics that were discussed, generally speaking, and maybe the position or the initials of an individual should be enough to jar the recollection of the people who are in charge of employment decisions. And I think we also can't think about this one exception to the Open Meetings Act in a vacuum, because there are seven other purposes that information is typically readily available. For instance, under 121.22G3, that's pending or imminent litigation, most governments are going to have in their public records what litigation was pending or imminent at the time. Same thing for collective bargaining negotiations. So I think, for the most part, in a government's general public records, they should be able to reconstruct the information if they're motivated to do so, because they have to produce evidence in order to avail
themselves.
Right,
so this is all something you'd like to see prospectively here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the court order this?
Did the court order what? I want to understand
all
your question.
The creation of some notes, the way your suggesting here?
No, they did not, Your Honor. And I think this court, in its opinion, could provide some roadmap to give the government's guidance on what kind of records they might want to take in order to satisfy their burden in the future.
But aren't, I mean, what all the OMA says as far as burdens of proof is that the plaintiff must provide proof of a violation or a threatened violation. I mean, you have what seem to be some good policy arguments why it doesn't make sense for a board to be able to just not have any information. And but aren't those really policy arguments that are directed to the General Assembly, better directed to the General Assembly, as the Attorney General says, rather than asking us to add something to the statute that's not there?
I don't think it requires you to add any more to the statute than what this court did in the Open Records Act.
It requires us to essentially change the or modify the burden of proof that's set forth in the statutory language.
Not any more so, because in an open meetings case, you have injunctive relief. In the open records case, you have mandamus. They're both the same. You always have the burden as a plaintiff. However, when the government's availing itself of the exception, and that's the difference here. So let's say a government is meeting privately or a government doesn't properly notice a special meeting. That burden is on the relator. We're talking
part
about
the burden of proof is where there's no evidence, where no one produces any evidence, the person who has the burden loses. And that's the situation here. There's really no evidence about what was discussed in the executive session. The only way that you actually can win this case is to change that burden that's set forth in the statute and say they have some burden to show something that was discussed in there.
Well, I think the burden exists independent of the statute because it's the burden of clear and convincing evidence. For instance, with an injunction, it's a clear and convincing standard. That's not in the statute. So when we talk about burden of proofs, they're often not laid out in a statute, and
the statute does say who has to prove what, and it says you have to prove it.
You have to prove the violation of the statute.
Correct.
But it doesn't say that you have to prove that the government has no burden of proof or that the government doesn't have to have information when it avails itself of an exception, because that was a decision in National Broadcasting that when a government is trying to prove an exception to its duty, it always has the burden. So if you look at this court's opinion in National Broadcasting, it did not limit that to the Open Records Act. It says in the state of Ohio, when someone is trying to avail themselves of a statutory duty, that burden is always on that person or entity. So National Broadcasting did not limit that holding or that policy to an open records case. On the contrary, it said always in all cases.
Okay, so you have the exception that is being noted by the commission. There's a mishmash of testimony. Nobody's coming up with any, you know, concrete testimony. A lot of the responses are, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that may be true, but I don't know, you know, that sort of thing. Okay, so I'm trying to understand how you're saying that the government fails to avail itself legitimately of an exception because nobody remembers what happened at the session. The executive session. That's basically what you are saying here, right?
Well, I think we're saying that they failed a burden of production, which I think is different than persuasion. And by not having the information, I think, yes, they're using...
Well, there's no requirement that they write down notes, minutes, tape record it, have somebody else in the room. None of that is required, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so you've got the commissioners who were in the meeting themselves, and these meetings happened, what, a year or two before they were asked about them?
Approximately about a year.
Okay, and they say, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you say that takes away their ability to shield themselves with an exception here. And therefore, they were inappropriately discussing matters that should have been presumably in open session?
I'm out of time. Can I answer this question? I think when there's an inference that they did violate it and they were not acting properly, and I think there is evidence and there's circumstantial evidence that created an inference. One was the notebook, one that they were only talking about one individual, and what they could remember pointed to a violation of the discussions not complying with the motion number one, and number two, them going outside of the four corner, going outside of the topic of conversation. So a lot like the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting scheme in an employment case, burden-shifting schemes are not unusual, and putting the government or placing some burden on an actor when it has a distinct advantage is nothing unusual. It's been used in the Open Records Act by this court, and it's used in this court's opinions on many employment issues.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Galvin.
Mr. Galvin, on your third assignment of error, your co-counsel said that reasonably believes is a subjective standard. And when I look at the statute, I can't be sure that it's not objective.
Well, I believe that, Your Honor, and by the way, Charles Galvin, on behalf of Amici with Frost Brown Todd, I believe that there is a subjective standard there because it requires the court to examine whether a well-informed public body would have believed that it was in violation of well-settled law. So there's a question there that is subjective to the court's interpretation as to the public body's knowledge of the law and whether that law is well-settled. So,
but it says, I think they pretty much hold up a reasonably informed public body. So isn't that objective?
I would find that that's subjective, but I think the subjectivity is in what does that public body believe to be the state of the law, and whether or not the court agrees that the state of the law is well settled in that case.
Thank you.
I would like to, on behalf of Amici, point out to this court two problematic outcomes with the appellee's position in this case. And the first this court has already honed in on, which is that in order for the appellees to prevail, the burden of proof in the underlying matter would necessarily be shifted from the party bringing the action to the public body that is engaging in executive session. The General Assembly has intended for certain exceptions to the Open Meetings Act to be held confidentially, and has outlined that violations of those exceptions must be proven by parties that seek to be find redress from the court. So in the General Assembly's intended language, there would need to be a shift. And that should be, if this court, which I've heard from some of the questioning, perhaps a desire for a shift in the policy and a dissatisfaction with the outcome of the statute as it is drafted, a solution to that statute should most likely come from the General Assembly that drafted that statute. The second problematic issue, though, is on behalf of the parties that I'm here representing, the most concerning thing for local governments, elected officials, administrators of local governments, is guidance. And right now, especially in the 12th District with this decision, how to conduct executive session effectively and efficiently and in the best interest of the communities that we represent, right now we're in a little bit of disarray. I alluded to this in the brief that I filed. Revised Code Section 102.03 specifically prohibits elected officials or other members participating in executive session from disclosing the contents of executive session. And there's no exception listed in that statute for being deposed in a matter of discovery. Obviously, there's a chilling effect that's occurred from this case in particular with the Claremont County Board of Commissioners, but that's no doubt spread to other communities and other local officials who would seek to only use executive session where they are not only allowed to, but required to by law in many cases.
Counsel, is it your experience that in these executive sessions it is usual or unusual for notes to be taken?
I would find that to be unusual, Your Honor. And I speak both as a counselor that provides guidance to local governments and also as a local government actor myself in my own community. That's something that, again, creates a public record, or at least the impression of those, you know, elected, are that that would create public record, and that's not something you're supposed to do in executive session.
Okay, so then how is the recollection of the commissioners supposed to be accurate, concrete, and able to be, well, you do have the problem of disclosures prohibited, so here they are being deposed, and they're asked to, did you talk about this, did you talk about that, et cetera. That could be disclosure, but what are they to do? How do these things to be orchestrated?
Well, I will admit that it does present a problem and perhaps even a gap in the goal of pursuing transparency. That's one that I would think is best situated for the legislature and the General Assembly to resolve. But in terms of what are they to do, I don't know that it's necessarily their burden to carry with filling in their recollection. Obviously, to the best of their ability, they'll try to recall what they discussed, but, you know, 10, 14 months since that last meeting, it's difficult to...
All right, say that there's an issue of whether someone should be terminated from employment, and they get together in executive session, and they're united in their decision, yes, we should go ahead and terminate, you know, for all the reasons, the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted, et cetera. How is that executive session decision communicated to the people who need to act as a result thereof?
In that example, after executive session, I don't know that it would be at the next meeting or a subsequent meeting, but there would perhaps be a resolution or recommendation from the administrator, or depending on the community, from a board member to take action, and the action being taken would be to terminate the employee, and then the public body would vote on that action.
All right, so then everybody knows that in the last executive session, this is what was discussed.
I think that's a reasonable inference, Your Honor.
Okay. Yeah. And okay, thank you.
Counsel?
Yes.
Just a question about the OMA, generally speaking. You agree that it is to promote openness and transparency in government?
I believe that's expressly stated in the OMA.
Okay. Your Honor. And so is it your position that it's reflected that the legislature only was concerned about stating the right thing to go into executive session and not concerned with what transpired in executive session?
I think that it was the legislature's intent to holistically identify certain topics that, because of the sensitivity of those topics, or, you know, whatever the implication may be. One other example would be security, for instance, and how do we protect, for instance, school buildings and things like that, that those topics should not be disclosed. I think it's probably been subsequent case law where we've maybe gotten far afield from either what the General Assembly intended or specifically stated as to whether those topics, it was sufficient to just go in and state them, or to, you know, we want you to be more specific than this. But I think as the law is written, that the underlying appellants have adhered to that, and I think that their practice is probably reflective more so than not of most public bodies in Ohio.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you're going to be notified of our decision. Thank you very much. Marshal, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.